from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Michael Andreessen, whose new story collection is The Sea Beast Takes a Lover, which came out in February from Dutton. Michael Andreessen holds a master's degree in creative writing from the University of California, Irvine. His fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, Tin House, Zoetrope All Story, Quarterly West, and elsewhere. He lives in Southern California. The Sea Beast Takes a Lover is his first book, and it's a whopper. Bewitching and playful, with its feet only slightly tethered to the world we know, The Sea Beast Takes a Lover explores hope, love, and loss across a series of surreal landscapes and wild metamorphoses. Just because Jenny was born without a head doesn't mean she isn't still annoying to her older brother. And just because the man of the future's carefully planned extramarital affair ends in alien abduction and network fame doesn't mean that he can't still pine for his absent wife. Romping through the fantastic with big-hearted ease, these stories cut to the core of what it means to navigate family, faith, and longing. Whether in the form of a lovesick sea beast slowly dragging a ship of sailors into the sea, a small town euthanizing its grandfathers in a time-honored ritual, or a third-grade field trip learning that time travel is even more wondrous and more perilous than they might imagine. Andreessen's stories are simultaneously daring and deeply familiar, unfolding in wildly inventive worlds that convey our common yearning for connection and understanding. The Sea Beast Takes a Lover uses the supernatural and extraordinary to expose us at our most human. I hope you enjoy our conversation, which happens to be the 500th broadcast of Write the Book.
I think each story's inspiration is different. Basically, in the beginning, I'm just looking for a way in, a way to get my foot in the door. And whatever that way is, I'll take it. Sometimes it's an image. Sometimes it's a particular character. Sometimes it's just you get the concept of, I wonder what would happen if instead of having to watch our elders die, we just sort of got rid of them.
Yeah.
So it really is just depending on the individual story. And honestly, if there was a method that worked well every time, I would take it. Yeah. But if there was one thing, but it's never just one thing for me, at least, you know, I think that it's that way for most writers that I know, that once we find our way in, we really don't question it. So it is different. I think, for the story, about the, amusement parks,
Things
Teacup at Rest, it was just the image of the bear in that story.
Yeah, I love that story. That's such a weird little story. Well, I have a question about that later, but yeah, go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, no, but, and so that one, and I kind of remember just building the story around that, but of course not all the stories were like that. The story Rite of Baptism was after actually attending and being baptism. For me, I sort of don't know when they're going to hit me, and I'm more of a burst writer. You know, I can't do the thing where you sit down every day and I'm just going to push through and get the words out. I need to have that little kernel, that little thing, or I can't start.
Yeah.
And so I'll take it wherever it comes.
Yeah. Now, if that kernel turns out not to bear fruit, like you start and then you realize it's not going anywhere, might you pursue that story from another angle, or do you tend to just give up and go to something else?
Usually if I can't get it going, it's one of two things. I either don't know the right approach, and that's actually something that if I'm struggling with the beginning of the story, I'm struggling with which character am I supposed to be with? What is the vantage of that character? You know, am I supposed to be in first person? I'll write it in first person for a while. That doesn't work. You'll go into third. You'll try it from another character's point of view. So if I'm struggling at the beginning, that's usually why. It's because I can't find the way in.
Okay. Yeah.
But also sometimes in the beginning, I just don't have enough inspiration, or I'll get bored. And so that is actually, I think, where some of the surrealistic elements come from.
Yeah.
It's just sort of in the drafting process, me kind of trying to just keep myself awake and alert and interested in what's going on.
Yeah. Now that's, I have a number of questions about that. So let's go right to one of those. So in these stories, you tend to blend, you know, fantastical, surreal things with grounding details. So like in your story, Bodies in Space, the narrator has to be careful when he showers and shampoos, which is a very normal activity, because aliens have installed a mysterious blinking light in his forehead, and he doesn't think he should probably get it wet. Or else, like in the story Jenny, a brother finds his sister irritating, which is a sort of normal thing, except that she has no head. So it's not normal at all. So, but it was funny because as I read the stories, I felt this kind of freedom. You know, it was like the world was so new and the world was so outside of my experience that I could just sort of let go and let you lead me along. You know, I wondered if that was something you were hoping for.
Oh, absolutely. That's kind of, I feel like the trick of surrealism, and, you know, when I'm reading my favorite authors who employ some kind of surrealistic or fabulous element, is we want to forget. I'm really attracted to situations that can exist with people in them who definitely could. And I think the sort of surrealistic elements of the stories, at least what I'm trying to do when I employ them, is to try to get at those aspects of character that are familiar to us.
Yeah.
Through a kind of unconventional path. And I think I don't know, the way I like to think about it is to take the most unfamiliar thing you can think of and use it to show somebody an incredibly familiar feeling. You know, it's like you say with Jenny, you know, none of us have the experience of having a sibling with a head. We all have the experience, or those of us with siblings have the experience, of sort of feeling this strange mixture of resentment and responsibility towards them.
Right.
And I think there's something about including elements of the surreal that kind of teases out those emotions or highlights them for me in a way that when I write realism, just kind of, they become pat. They're the same feelings and they come from the same places. But I think because we're not expecting them, because we're expecting something silly or something outrageous, we're kind of ambushed by those feelings and by that similarity. And so I'm really glad to hear that was your reaction, because I think that's often kind of what I'm going for, is to try to surprise the audience with something familiar in a place where they might not have found it otherwise.
Right. And I would say that what I do find familiar, what I do recognize in these stories, tends to always be, I mean, other than the sort of regular details of a life that some are mixed in with the surreal, but I also would recognize emotion, desire, tragedy, you know, that sort of larger underpinning, you know, is what's familiar. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that's kind of always what you're looking for. You know, that was, I sort of grew up reading a lot of fantasy and sci-fi, and for me, the best fantasy and sci-fi was always the stories about what seems like regular people in these fantastic worlds. Because it gets... If I'm trying to imagine myself as a young kid in this fantasy world, I want to see somebody who's going to react to the way I react. And so in my adult writing, that's always what I'm trying to look for, is trying to forget for a moment that all of these fantastic things are happening and just deal with the person.
Yeah.
And just try to imagine in these circumstances, how would a normal person forget the giant crate dropping into the ocean, forget the girl with no head, forget the bear, forget all of these other weird things. And just try to react in an honest way that you think an honest person would react. And that always grounds the story in a way that sort of keeps the surrealness from floating too far away.
Yeah. Now often when you begin your story, you'll start with some line or some indication that lets us know something about that world that you've created that we're about mm-hmm. to read about. So for example, in the mm-hmm. in the story Blunderbuss, which actually ends your collection, the opening line mm-hmm. is, "Welcome, welcome," the time travelers say, their voices echoing through the too spacious, too empty lobby of the Time Travel Institute. So, like, that's the opening line, and right there we're like, whoa, okay. So can you just talk a little bit about this and about just maybe even openings in general?
Yeah, sure. I think part of the reason I like to do it that way is I'm not interested in being coy with the reader. And it gets to what we were talking about earlier about if you're interested in showing a human emotion or a human experience that is familiar, then I don't want my reader sort of being confused. I don't, or being lost in sort of like the strange world. And so my solution to that is to try to be as upfront as possible, to not withhold sort of circumstances of this world, to explain it early on and make sure everybody knows the rules and what's happening here so that we can get to the characters and mm-hmm. so that we can focus on them. I think, yeah, part of the reason I want to establish early, like we're at a time travel institute, is if my reader is trying to figure out where we are in those first few pages and doesn't really understand what's happening very clearly because I'm being coy, then they're not going to be thinking about the characters. They're going to be trying to figure out the rules of the world.
Right.
And so I would rather just explain the rules or explain the weirdness as early and as quickly as possible so that I could spend the rest of the time focusing on what's going on with these people on an emotional level.
Yeah, right. Now, I will say that the opening story in your collection is called Our Fathers at Sea. And I thought this one was maybe, I felt almost like it trained me in how to read your work because it was a little bit more conventional as far as what the world looks like, except for this one really bizarre ritual, which you already mentioned, which is, you know, basically the extermination of their grandfathers. And as the story unfolds, we sort of learn what's happening to these grandfathers. But it kind of led me into this collection with like a kind of normal looking world. But then, you know, there's this thing happening, and the narrator himself is very conflicted about it too. The story is told from the point of view of this guy whose own father, he's a father himself, and his own father is being taken away to fulfill this weird societal tradition. And it's written in the second person, which is, it's almost like this kind of sad love letter to the grandfather.
Right.
So I wondered how you came to this narrative presentation. It was really interesting, and I liked it a lot.
That story, it's funny. That was one we were talking earlier about how you're starting with. That was one I was having a really difficult time getting into.
Oh wow!
I knew I wanted to write about that sort of topic, mostly because at the time that I got the idea for a story, this was actually, I mean, this character is nothing like my father, but I was my father was sort of going through something similar with his father, and my grandfather was passing away, and I was watching my father sort of navigate some of those feelings. And I think, you know, in my desire to be protective of my father, that's where the thought comes from. Oh, you know, I of course love my grandfather, but it was one of those moments where, oh, I wish we didn't have to deal with this. You know, I wish this could be easier on him. I wish there was just some way to just be done with it.
I wish there was just a ritual.
I wish there was just a rich, yeah, you know, and then immediately caught myself and I was like, okay, number one, that's a horrible thing to say. And number two, that's not a terrible idea for a story. And so that's where it came from. But I was having such a hard time in the beginning, you know, is it first person? Is it third person? You know, if I'm first person's hard in explaining some of these, you know, the aspects of this ritual and stuff, you know, because you're limited by perspective. So it's kind of jumping around and having a hard time getting in. And then somewhere in that process that you came up. And at the time I had no idea who the you was, you know, and I thought maybe we just had like a first person narrator, you know, just talking to a general you, that writers sometimes do, you know, engaging with the reader and imagine. And then that you, it seemed really like he was talking to the you a lot and almost kind of making a case to the you.
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, oh, maybe he's talking to somebody here. Because the story, as you say, I didn't want to make it like overly sentimental or overly kind of anguished, because I really did want this ritual to feel like something that was just accepted, you know, that he feels bad for the way it kind of goes throughout the day, but I don't think he ever questions the validity or the rightness of having this ritual. I didn't want to do that because I didn't want to turn it into this moral quandary of, oh, like, you know, someone associating it with, I didn't want it to be about euthanasia or about what do we do about the elderly. I wanted it to be about a guy who has a certain vision, again, something a little more universal or something a little more that we've all felt, has an idea for how this very important thing should go and how he reacts when it doesn't go that way.
Right.
You know, he has high hopes, you know, this day sort of needs to be, it's a ceremony and it's meant to be a kind of dignified thing. And there are certain things that have taken away from that dignity over the years. Like now it's in a strip mall parking lot and that's sort of undignified, but this guy's trying to hold it together. You know, he's trying to keep this. He's trying to wrangle his family. He's trying to make sure he says the right things or does the right things. And that is the anxiety that I wanted to drive the story.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized that if you stick with that too much, then it becomes really impersonal, because the grandfather, who is mute in the story, really is just kind of this object that's negotiated. And I wanted there to be some kind of a slightly deeper connection without sacrificing that idea that this is something the character accepts. So I think that's where the you came from. When it popped up, it was a great relief, because I was like, this is great. We can have this. This will help with this connection,
right,
and help create this kind of like emotional bond between these two men without having to necessarily on the surface say all of those feelings or make this about this kind of issue. This
yeah.
is this. So that is kind of like the kind of the emotional umbilical cord that connects the two.
Yeah. I also really liked that you include in the story the narrator's two sons, who, first of all, are very different in personality from each other, but also they just really round out the story of his own. You know, we are thinking about his future as well as we as we read this story, and that seemed so important. You know, by the end, I thought that was great.
I think it is a story about fathers and sons. So, and it's kind of what was on my mind at the time. So it made sense to include some, but yeah, I think eventually at the end we are thinking, okay, well, who is going to perform this service for our narrator? And, you know, as you say, his two sons are very different.
Right.
One is very sensitive, and so sensitive that he kind of is annoying to the narrator and kind of messes things up, or doesn't mess things up, the narrator perceives it that way because of his oversensitivity. And the other is kind of overly callous, and that's the son we're kind of left with at the end.
Right.
So I do like the idea of eventually it's going to be, you know, we're going to be doing this again, but with this son who we I don't know that we really like him or trust him.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is kind of the question of, okay, is he going to put in the same effort you know, when his time comes around, or is it going to be kind of even worse than this, kind of even colder? But, yeah. But I think the thing about Ernest, that son, is he has a good sense of what's necessary. And so part of me believes, you know, I normally don't like to think about what happens to characters after the story, because that gets in the way of where you end it and the note you want to end on. But I do think at some point he sort of like takes on this necessary responsibility, because that's kind of what that story is. We do what's necessary, and we do it as best we can.
Right.
So yeah, I think so.
Now, I wanted to just mention, I think one reason that, well, I think this is important in all stories, but maybe particularly with these stories because of the surreal element we've talked about. But I think one of the reasons that these work so well is the vividness of the language. Do you mind if I read a paragraph from the book and then we can talk a little bit about it?
Not at all. Please do.
Okay, so this is from the title story, the title of the book again being The Sea Beast Takes a Lover. And in this story, a giant tentacled sea creature falls in love with a ship called the Winsome Bride. And gradually, over weeks, I think, it drags this ship underwater. Mm-hmm. So this is just a paragraph from that story. The water is higher by morning, and the sailmasters are slow and lubberly in the rigging. Though every inch of the Winsome Bride has a pearlescent luster, the air above deck is thin and foul. There is no tide or wind, and the clouds on the horizon seem farther away than ever. The tentacles return warily, but in greater numbers. They slither the deck with lethal calm, poised like tigers in the veld. No more curiosity or playful loping. Our long courtship is over. When they are ready, they will have us, and that's that. And it's funny because I really felt like the language in this collection was very vivid and I actually just sort of opened randomly and put my finger down, and that's the paragraph, and I thought, okay, well, that's a perfectly good one to use, but really the whole collection is full of this incredibly beautiful and very specific language. So I think my question is, how much time do you spend getting the words just right, and what is your revision process like when it comes down to the line level?
Oh, gosh.
I know. I'm sorry. It's a lot of question.
No. How much time do I spend getting the words right? The answer to that one is too much time, probably. But really, I mean, now I can hear my writing teachers yelling at me and saying, there's no such thing as too much time on the words. The words were, you know, and so I suppose that is kind of how I approach it, is getting the words right is the whole thing. But it's also, I think it's important to me because that's where the energy comes from. Mm-hmm. When I'm drafting, I'm just trying to keep enough, power in the batteries to get to the end. And if you have to bring in, some kind of surreal nonsense to do that, if you have to like just make the vocabulary insane, whatever it is, the writer Ron Carlson talks about this, just surviving the draft, he calls mm-hmm. it. But with editing, it becomes very much about the language. But you don't want to lose that energy. And so if you've stumbled across a kind of vocabulary, or if you've stumbled across even a few particular words, I really try to hold on to them, or hold on to that tone and maintain that tone, just so it has enough energy to carry me and, of course, carry the reader all the way to the end. Plus, I mean, why are we doing this if we're not trying to stretch the bounds of language?
Right.
I do think, if you're a writer, you just love words. I don't know a single writer who doesn't. I don't know a single writer that doesn't have a list somewhere of all of their favorite words, and, you know, words, whether it's because the words are complicated or just the sound. I mean, I have a list, and on that list are some, you know, great $5, you know, SAT vocab words. It's just some really simple words that have this great, that just feel great in the mouth. And,
yeah, I think concatenation was in your book. Concatenation.
Oh God, isn't that beautiful? I worried about it. I worried about it because it's a kind of out there word, but I love concatenation.
Yeah.
And part of this too, you know, I have no doubt readers will read this and stumble across a word that seems kind of strange or maybe a little out of place. And it's just there because I love it. It's just there because I couldn't not use that particular word, like concatenation. Even saying it, you know, you get caught on those hard K sounds.
Yeah.
And, oh. So, I mean, part of it is just for me, the language is a toy. It's playful, and we're meant to play with it, and we're meant to have fun with it. And I feel like the more you do, the more you're looking for that language that's your own,
mm-hmm.
the more energy you're bringing to the story.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily like a high flowery vocabulary, but just finding the, you know, I think, Our Fathers at Sea has a, you know, it's a first person narrative. It keeps things pretty simple, but in that case, then you have to find the energy from somewhere. But I love drawing the energy from the language, and especially with the title story. Gosh, nautical language
yeah.
is just amazing.
Yeah.
And I mean that was a story where I was always worried I was going a little too far because I'd be doing reading or research or just going to those books that I love, and finding all of these new words. Lubberly, come
yeah,
on.
Right.
I mean, just the, I'm so glad you read that one with that word. That is just one of my favorite nautical words of all time. So for that story, I think a lot of that early energy comes from that language, and I draw a lot of energy from it. And so that is, I think, where a lot of those choices come from. But then you have to maintain that energy when you're editing, you know, and when you're making the good, judicious choices. And that's hard because sometimes the best sounding word is not the best word for the job.
Yes. Yeah. Now, these stories are also very funny sometimes.
I'm glad you think so.
Well, and the humor sits alongside, you know, a lot of deeper, sometimes sad emotion too. But anyway, so you have this story called The Saints in the Parlor. And oh my God, this story, I know it's not a funny story, but there were really funny moments. And so even just the saints that are in the title include Saint Her Own Hand on a Plaint, Saint Upside Down Skull, Saint Tongue of Flame, whose forehead has this flame in it, which you write, jubilates, ejecting at small sparks and somersaulting with zeal. I don't know, like Saint Tongue of Flame says, your holy providence, the better to serve thee. And then, you know, Saint Upside Down Skull says, thy holy providence, the better to serve thee, or you, your, don't mix forms or metaphors, says
right.
Saint Her Own Hand
right.
on a Plate. And it was just funny. There was a lot that was funny in that story, even though there was also a lot that was kind of sad and freaky. But anyway,
mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the humor in your work?
Sure. You know, almost all of my favorite writers use humor.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big part of why they're my favorite writers. Even Kafka and his incredibly dark humor. I remember coming to him, you know, that's one of those names where you hear the name before you read and you get the idea that this is a very important writer. And for a long time, I thought very important writers wrote about very important things and they wrote about them very seriously. And then you finally encounter Kafka, and this guy is hilarious.
Yeah.
He is just, and that is what makes the darkness and the seriousness palatable. So sometimes I'm using humor just because my favorite writers do, but also I think, like you said, these these stories do get kind of sad and they do get kind of bleak, and that can make them, I don't think hard to get through, but when you're sharing that space with a character, there needs to be some buoyancy, I think. And
you have to find a way that your reader can connect.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think and you have to find a way that you can connect.
Right.
I think I said earlier, you know, sometimes I'm just looking, we talked about energy and we talked about, what gets you in and what keeps you awake during a story. And for better or for worse, when I'm reading, I'll kind of enjoy anything, you know, whatever you put in front of me, realism, surrealism, you know, poetry, prose. I just I get a kick out of it, and I can usually find something. But when I'm writing, I get very bored with my own writing, because it's not coming from a novel place. It's coming from my brain, which I hang out with that thing all the time, and I'm kind of bored with it by now. So I do find that I am constantly trying to find ways to keep myself entertained and to keep myself engaged in the story. And humor is one of those things where if I can generate a voice that I like or a circumstance that is funny, then I'm kind of in it. And then I'm paying attention because I'm being entertained. These guys are funny. I like hanging out in this place. This place is weird and unusual and I'm having a lot of fun. And again, I think that what gives me some energy, which lets me translate some of that energy into the writing. But humor is another great source of energy, and it also lets you get away with some tricks, which it lets you sometimes ambush the reader in a nice way, where you've got them on your side, we're having fun, we're laughing, and then you do throw in a kind of heavy moment or a kind of heavy realization. And the more I can do to surprise the reader with that resonance or surprise the reader with that familiar thing. That's what I like is you're reading and you're having fun and this is weird and this is funny. And, this is no big deal. This is just the story for kicks. I don't know what this is. There's a king, there's this bear, who knows? It's wild. And then you come to the real thing. Then you come to loneliness or loss or not knowing your place in the world. And suddenly all that humor sort of, you realize it was just kind of a smokescreen. I don't mean to suggest that it's a trick because, you know, I do think, yeah, as writers, we want to provoke thought and emotion, but we're also here to entertain. We're also here to encourage you to spend your time with us. We want your time. And so we have to earn it. Right. And if I can earn that by making you laugh as well as, you know, making you feel things, absolutely, I'm going to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. I wonder, how important to you are character names? Like, you know, like those saints you had to get just right, so that, I'm not talking about that, but like you have, in this collection, you have a Dizzy, you have a Fab, you have a Sip, but you also have an Andy and a Gavin and a Connie. I think in the opening story, the name Ernest was interesting to me. Uh-huh. So anyway, I'm just curious, like, to what extent are you letting character names carry meaning, or how important are they in that way?
I mean, there are definitely occasions where they serve a function. Like, for example, the Saints in the Parlor that you were talking about, you know, those names are chosen, number one, because I didn't want to locate these in actual saints. But the inspiration for that story was very much drawn from, you know, we were talking about where ideas come from. That one was, I was remembering a lot of portraits in a picture book of saints that I had when I was a kid. I grew up Catholic. And so a lot of those were just that's sort of the defining, that's the way those saints appear in my head in a kind of portrait way. And I just decided and rather than go through the trouble of, oh, should I find real saints? Should I give them names? That might be kind of weird. How do they know each other's names? Instead I was just, no, let's just pick one sort of defining characteristic and that's what we'll call them. But it's funny. I really hadn't thought about it. And then when you ask that question, you put the normal names alongside, like, yeah, Sip and Fab. And, I think you're just looking for, unless the names are sort of like serving an actual function, I think you're just looking for the thing that feels so natural, you don't see it. And so I often, you know, I know some people who change names and constantly, and they're just trying to get the name right. And most of the time I pick one and don't think about it again.
Right.
And that's not to say it's not worthy of thinking about, but I just want it to feel comfortable enough that it sort of fades into the background. Although it's a good, yeah, it never occurred to me. Sip, that is a weird name, isn't it? Now that I kind of look at it. Sometimes this happens where it seems perfectly normal to you. And then someone points it out and you're like, yeah, that's weird. You're right. I don't know. But names, if it's comfortable, if it sounds right, sometimes it's just that the phonics of it, If it sounds right, I'll take it and I'll move on.
And isn't that interesting? I mean, the phonics of it are kind of going back to what we were saying about language. You know, I mean, sometimes the language that you choose is about the beautiful word, and sometimes it's just about the word that feels right in the situation. So it's interesting that names can also sort of have that effect.
Totally, yeah. And I think it's an opportunity to maybe we don't quite think about how much nicknames are a part of our lives until we see a nickname that's strange, and then we think about all the strange nicknames in our lives. So it's another way to kind of connect with a sort of mundanity that is more grounding in these stories that might get away from us otherwise.
Yeah. Now, I did notice you seem to enjoy including technology in some of the stories, and that forehead implant, or in the story there's this story about a boy who's literally like flying around with the help of rockets. I was curious if this is just a long time love of science fiction, or do you have science in your background or what?
It is entirely a love of science fiction.
Okay.
It is that sort of like many writers I know, that's where I cut my teeth. You know, we eventually all graduate to the various forms of literature. But yeah, I was that kid who was just camped out in the library next to the sci-fi and fantasy section, just sort of devouring these musty old paperbacks. And so technology, for me, sometimes it even feels like a character in the story you're describing in the Rocket Boy story. It's definitely, you know, a lot of that world is visualized through these kind of strange technologies. And I think for me, technology should never be the focal point. But it lends itself so much, especially strange technology or advanced technology, science fiction technology, lends itself so much to looking at human things. This is why our great the great sci-fi writers are really humanists and are deeply conscious and care about character.
Yeah.
But the technology is almost always a vehicle to kind of understand those characters better. But it's a great vehicle for that.
Yeah.
And I love using it for that purpose. I'm not really interested in the time travel story. My hope is that it comes across much more about those kids and about those time travelers than about the technology. In fact, the technology is kind of sitting in the background, and we don't really, at one point in that story, the time travel device leaks.
Yeah.
And I have no idea what that means, by the way. I don't know what it's leaking or why it's leaking or what the fact that it's leaking, does something in the story and brings about something. And I think technology has, especially advanced technology, which can kind of do anything, is a wonderful vessel for that.
Yeah, okay. So I wonder if you can share the names of some of your favorite story writers, or maybe science fiction writers, since we were just talking about that, but also story writers.
Absolutely, yeah. I still remember when I was in college picking up George Saunders for the first time. And having that moment where you're encountering something completely new, that what is this moment? And so he was a very important one for me. I feel like you hear writers talk a lot about permission, the books that give them permission to do something. I didn't know you could have this kind of character, or I didn't know that you could, write a book with this kind of structure. And I feel like he was definitely one of those where the humor is so present, but is never just about the humor and the languages. I think I heard him once describe the language as jangly. He's looking for a jangliness in language.
And
that is such an apt description of it. So Saunders is one I've just been following, relentlessly for a long time.
Yeah. Lincoln in the Bardo. I can see Lincoln in the Bardo being very much sort of a book that might have influenced the writing of The Sea Beast Takes a Lover. I didn't think about that till you just said that. But
Sure. Yeah. Well, and so many of those collections, In Persuasion Nation and Civil War Land and Bad Decline, even just that title story, revelatory for me. Donald Barthelme is another one where, he is actually a person I go back to again and again, not just because and the surrealist. But he is such a great tutor in economy and just sort of getting in and getting out. You know, do your thing, choose all the right words so that you don't have to choose too many words. He's also a great riffer. You know, you can see so many stories of his, and there are so many, that begin with kind of a joke or a dare or like just sort of a fun idea.
Right.
You know, whether it's like the school and the fun idea is, these, you know, kids in this class, you know, everything keeps dying. Every animal they adopt, every plant they try to take care of. And it starts funny, and it's a great way to start. And then it becomes very much, it turns serious and dark very quickly and becomes very much a story about life and death. I think he has a story called Concerning the Bodyguard. And it's a story that's really, it sounds like a dare. It's, you know, I dare you to write a story that is only questions. And Donald Barthelme is like, I'll take that bet. Yeah, sure. and so those, I turn to him usually, sometimes I turn to him when I'm having a hard time getting in and I'm just looking for an interesting or a novel way to kind of get into a story. Each one of those, you know, 40 to 60 stories, so that's 100 total and more, you know, each one of those is a little lesson. And I try to take them in that way. Then, you know, we have so many great surrealists now that I draw a lot of inspiration from, Amy Bender and Kelly Link and, you know, all of the Karen Russell. And so This is really, if you're into this kind of fiction, this is a great time to be alive and reading. We have so many wonderful voices.
Those are
a few that, especially Saunders and Barthelme and Kafka, like you talked about earlier, those are the ones I go back to whenever I need a lesson or whenever I need a little bit of inspiration. I go back to those books again and again.
Okay. All right. And what are you working on now? Are you writing something new?
I am trying. The interesting thing that I didn't know when a book comes out is you spend a lot of time sort of writing little pieces here and there. And so right now I'm kind of working on small, you know, essays or posts or things like that. But I am...
Like your letter to librarians. I saw that.
Yes, exactly. Things like that. You know, and it's nice to write those. And actually, that was a great one to write because we were talking about possible promotions, and I'm such a fan of libraries as any writer is. And so,
right.
So they're great opportunities and they're great little things to write, but they do kind of take away from, you know, getting back in the saddle in terms of starting on the next book. It's hard for me to focus on one thing for too long. And that I think is going to make a novel particularly difficult, but I am going to try to take it on. I've started a little bit and it is kind of exciting to, it's just a totally different form and it allows for totally different ways to explore ideas. You have so much more elbow room, my God. So I'm trying that, but you know, even in the past few months, I've stopped and started new stories just because you have to go where that energy is. You have to follow it. And sometimes you sit down and you're not feeling the novel, but you got a weird idea for a story last night. And maybe let's just write the first couple of pages of that and just see where it goes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Hopefully soon I'll sort of buckle down and focus on a novel idea or something longer. I would like to try that now that this first collection is kind of out of the way, but gosh, I think I'll always love stories.
Yeah.
It'll be hard to kick that habit. Yes, I hope so. I hope that's how people feel. Because that's really where my heart is.
Okay. And so I always like to end these interviews by asking for a little bit of advice for writers. And in your case, I wondered if you could offer some advice for creating worlds and maybe with an eye to the rules that you follow to keep things logical within each world, if not entirely like consistent or like our own world. Or if you want to take it in another direction, just advice for creating worlds.
I think for me, like I said, when I'm drafting, I kind of let anything in the door. any weirdness, any zaniness, anything that's going to inject a little life into the story. But I think when you're editing, which is where a lot of the most important work happens, if you're working in surrealism, there is this idea that, you know, anything can happen and any kind of craziness is great. But I think when it comes time to edit and think seriously about a surreal world, really the point of focus is incredibly important. And mm-hmm. so my advice, or the thing that I try to do, is just focus on one thing. That thing can have repercussions and reverberations, but I think if we try to bring in too much, the world can get too, there are too many free radicals to control, and the world can get too complicated. And so that's why, you know, like you say in Rocket Boy, it's that technology. It's that world is a little, it's higher up in the sky, and it's a lot of aerial technology. And that has led to kind of all of these things,
right.
Including voyeurism. You know, we have this great vantage on everybody. We can kind of see everybody. And so that one thing has a lot of themes and affects the story in different ways, but it's still just that one aspect. Even stories that seem to have a lot of weird things going on, like, you know, The King's Teacup at Rest, there, it's not necessarily a technology or one weird thing, but it's this kind of idea of loneliness and exploring these different ideas. We never get too far from that theme. And so I think for me, what I try to do is find the one thing in this world that's different. The one thing that's a little strange or a little offbeat. And then how does that ripple out and how does that have different effects? But when we try to include too much, that's where it can kind of get away from us and spiral out. That, you know, I kind of don't like the term grounding, because it's such a, it's a word that I think we associate with like a kind of restraint, but it is important for the feat of a story to be attached to the ground in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise it's all fantasy and it's all frivolous and we don't have to pay attention to it. We don't have to care about it. So I guess my advice is find that one thing that makes this world different, and don't worry about explaining that thing too much. That's where we get a little bit into sci-fi. I'm really obsessed with the technology and how the technology works. I wouldn't worry so much about that, but how does this ripple out and affect the people in different ways? I think that's what we're really after when we come to fiction, is to see how human lives might be a little different if this one thing in our world was a little different.
Okay. Oh, I love that. And I did say earlier that I had a question about the King's Teacup at Rest, but we sort of covered my question, but we've mentioned it a few times, so I just want to mention that it concerns a king who collects abandoned amusement parks, and he has this odd little entourage that accompanies him, and so it includes, as we mentioned, a dancing bear who never comes down off of his ball, and a young scout who the bear has taken under his wing, and a royal steward. So I'm glad you mentioned that the thread of that one is loneliness, because in fact, all of the characters, including the king, have some sort of loneliness.
One of my writing teachers once described it as this phenomenon we encounter sometimes in stories as the black hole in the story, which is the thing in the story that you can't really see directly, but that everything else is caught up in.
Yeah.
And if I, you know, that's why I think I sort of let myself get away with having a lot of zaniness in that story, because it did all seem to be kind of circling the drain of this idea of loneliness. So we never got too, even though we were running off with a bunch of crazy characters, we never got too far away from this feeling. And these, you know, these abandoned amusement parks are these very lonely and desolate places.
Yeah.
So long as that theme or that general mood was there, I felt like we were still kind of in the ballpark.
Okay. Michael Andreessen, I want to thank you one more time. I want to just mention that the name of the book is The Sea Beast Takes a Lover. It's a story collection published by Dutton. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Michael Andreessen. We discussed his new story collection, The Sea Beast Takes a Lover, published by Dutton. You can learn more about Michael's work at michaelandreessen.net, and his last name is spelled A-N-D-R-E-A-S-E-N. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Michael Andreessen. Try to find an oblique angle, an odd vector of approach. Sometimes this is as simple as not starting in the place where you have the impulse to start. So if your characters are in a room, perhaps begin in the other corner of that same room from the one that they're in. Maybe describe the air coming in the vents or something happening outside the window, or maybe a sink in a nearby bathroom is making a noise. Move the focus someplace else. We have such an urge to get to the one thing we want to talk about, and sometimes talking about only that one thing can become boring. A dripping faucet, or for example, an unattended child spotted through a window who's about to walk into the street, these might not be the one things we want to talk about, but they can ramp up the tension in the story. So give that a shot. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at 99.3wbtv.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.